Hi, Justine. Yes, it's. I really like to thank you. Thanks, Bryn, Alexa, Unit Pitt, for giving us this opportunity to give voice to the things I find important to be voiced. A little thing about us, our company, Arash and I and Pajad, is called The Biting School, and started with a 10-minute piece that we made in a park for Vancouver Biennale, basically, in 2013, and then slowly it developed. We made a piece for, the first one was Righteous Floater, based on Cain and Abel, and then we made it for Dancing on the Edge, with great help with David and Battery Opera. We rehearsed in their studio. And then another piece of our ashes in Dancing on the Edge of the next year, 2014, and all of them in Dance Days Victoria. Yes, that's so far. Arash is a dancer, choreographer. Ario, myself, is I'm an actor, dramaturg, and sometimes director. And Pajad also, who's not here, he's a designer, lighting and video and set design, basically. Yes. We were searching for names, and then we were seeing, getting feedbacks from friends at some point. The company's called The Biting School. And my friend Elise Cheadle sent us something which I like to, it appeals to me, I really like it. It might give an idea of what we like. The biting school is in my throat. The biting school is being disciplined harshly and publicly by your teacher in front of the class. The biting school is also philosophical revolution. The biting school is the name of the newest Hollywood comedy starring Liv Tyler. The biting school is new and curious. The biting school is musical more than theatrical. The biting school is memorable. The biting school sticks to the lining of my skull. The biting school is goo candy sweet. Which is lovely. Now, today I wonder about a talk. I'm just going to talk about one of my obsessions. I'm going to, which is Howard Barker. He's a British playwright. I'm going to read mostly his stuff, basically a collage of what he has written, and then hopefully we can see if it's interesting to talk about at all. I've been obsessed with his work for the past. 5-6 years, maybe. A lot of my theater friends know that. And all my friends, I guess. What is... He's 70 years old right now, I guess. And he's written over 35 plays. He started with Royal Court Shakespeare and writing plays for them, but his plays were absolutely unconventional that they basically fired him. It was like, okay, we can't produce your plays. And he's been translated and performed in Europe and the United States. He's written plays for marionettes. He's written 3 librettos for operas. And he's author of 2 works of theory, which I'll be reading from one of them, Arguments for Theater, and 5 volumes of poetry. He's also a painter. And yes, Howard Barker's plays... Yeah, I did say that. Are known for their fearless exploration of power, sexuality, and human motivation. His texts overflow with rich language, challenging ideas, history, beauty, violence, and imaginative comedy, all brought together within the extremes of human experience. Barker's texts are constructed on the premise that theater is a necessity in society, a place for imagination and moral speculation, not constrained by the demands of realism or any ideology. Barker describes his work with the term theater of catastrophe. In Barker's work, no attempt is made to satisfy any demand for clarity or deceptive simplicity of a single message. Each performance is like a public challenge in which actors and audience are inspired to find meaning and resonance from a multiplicity of interpretations. I'm not going to get into Deleuze. I know how many people love Deleuze, but no. Theater of Catastrophe takes as its first principle the idea that art is not a digestible, rather it is an irritant in consciousness. He puts some theater catastrophe in opposition to humanist theater. Now, he calls, he sets them against each other like this, like the humanist theater, in the humanist theater, we all really agree. In the catastrophic theater, we only sometimes agree. In the humanist theater, when we laugh, we are together. In the catastrophic theater, laughter conceals fear. In the humanist theater, art must be understood. In the catastrophic theater, art is a problem of understanding. Wit greases the message. There is no message. The actor is a man or a woman, not unlike the author. The actor is different in kind. The production must be clear, the humanist theater. The audience cannot grasp everything, nor did the author. We celebrate our unity. We quarrel to love. The critic is already on our side. The critic must suffer like everyone else. The message is important. The play is important. The audience is educated and goes home happy or fortified. The audience is divided and goes home disturbed or amazed. Now, yes, a little bit of what he has written. This is a collection of whatever he has written. I have, let's see, 45. This one is called Honoring the Audience. The word which has seeped into the vocabulary is celebration. We do not know what to celebrate, however, if only because at certain times there is nothing to celebrate. The theater we have created celebrates nothing. Though it is usually filled with laughter, laughter appears to be a manifestation of solidarity, but it is now more often a sign of subordination. It is pain that the audience needs to experience, and not contempt. We have a theater of contempt masquerading as comedy. It is always the case that the audience is willing to know more and to endure more than the dramatist or producer trusts it with. The audience has been treated as a child, even by the best theaters. The theater is not a disseminator of truth, but a provider of versions. Its statements are provisional. In a time when nothing is clear, the inflicting of clarity is a stale arrogance. Same piece that he's written, Honoring the Audience. A theater which honors its audience will demand of its writers that they write in hazard of their conscience. For writers are paid to think dangerously. They are the explorers of the imagination. The audience expects it of them. If they think safely, what is the virtue of them? Do you want to pay £10 to be told what you knew already? That is theft. Do you want to agree all the time? That is flattery. And the audience is always flattered, which is why it has become so sleek. An honored audience will quarrel with what it has seen. It will go home in a state of anger, not because it disapproves, but because it has been taken where it was reluctant to go. It will go home in a state of anger, not because it disapproves, but because it has been taken where it was reluctant to go. Thus, morality is created in art by exposure to pain and the illegitimate thought. A new theater will be overambitious. It will not settle for anything less than a full company of actors. The stage should swarm with life. No new writers should be taught economy, no matter what the economy demands. The new writers should be shown that the stage is a relentless space and never a room. If the new writer is thought economy, the theater will itself shrink to the size of an attic. It is probably time to shut the studio theaters in the interests of theater. Now, I'll read a part of one of his plays. It's an adaptation of Hamlet. It's called Gertrude the Cry. I'm fascinated how he gives voice to different parts that in Shakespeare's Hamlet were repressed. And I've always been fascinated how he does that. In this version, Hamlet is not a huge character. Gertrude is the focus, of course. And I simply read the beginning of it. Yeah, let's see what time that is. Gertrude the Cry. We have Gertrude here, and we also have Claudius, Hamlet's uncle, who's gonna kill his brother. And there's only me, so I'm gonna use this gesture as Gertrude and this as Claudius. The servant later, too. The orchard at Elsinore. A king asleep on the ground. Gertrude. Entering. I should. Surely I should. Me. Claudius. No. Me, let me. It must be me who. Why not me? Me who. He is my husband. Why not me? Because he is your husband, it must be me. Let me kill. Oh, let me kill for you. I'm killing, Claudius. I'm killing me. Kill my husband then. Kill him for me. Strip. Strip? Naked. Strip naked, yes. Let me see the reason I'm killing. Yes. Yes. And if he stirs, if his eyes open in his agony, show him the reason he's dying. Let him see what I have stolen, what was his, and what now belongs to me. The thing, let the dying dog's eyes swim your... He's not a dog. I called him a dog. Do it now. If anyone's a dog, do it now. It's me. Gertrude positions herself above the head of the sleeping man, tilted provocatively. Poison him. Claudius goes to kiss Gertrude. She shuts her eyes, averts her face. Poison him. Claudius takes the phial from his clothing. He kneels by the sleeping man. He pours the fluid into the man's ear. Gertrude seems to vomit in her ecstasy. Her cry mingles with the cry of the sleeping man who shudders. Fuck me, oh fuck me. Claudius and Gertrude couple above the dying man. All three utter a music of extremes. A servant enters, holding a garment and attends. All ecstasy makes ecstasy go running to a further place, that is, its penalty. We know this, how well we know this. Still, we would not abolish ecstasy, would we? We would not say this ever-receding quality in ecstasy makes it unpalatable, on the contrary. We run behind it, limping, staggering. I saw it there, I saw it there. A haunting mirage on the rim of life. Thank you for listening. Now, the figure of Hamlet has been appropriated in so many different works, of course, mostly in the 60s as a rebellious or a hedonist person, a hero. But Hamlet in here is a different character. Hamlet's squeamishness over matters sexual, especially his dealing with Ophelia, have never made this association particularly convincing. In Gertrude the Cry, Barker is keen to emphasize Hamlet's infantilism, for example, dressing him in the original 2002 production as an English public schoolboy. And the misogynistic repulsion towards female sexuality that is omnipresent in Shakespeare's play. Barker's Hamlet is described by his grandmother, Isola, who doesn't exist in Shakespeare's play, but in this play she exists, as a boor and a prude. Now, this is when Hamlet sees his dead father. Hamlet, this is Hamlet, maybe. Hamlet examines the face of his dead father, formerly displayed. He lets fall the cloth that covers the face. I expected to be more moved than this. Cascades, storms of, torrents of emotion. Never mind, these things will come later when I least expect them. In bed, with a bitch, or on a horse. Eyes full of tears, you're crying, she will say. You're crying, the horse will neigh. Yes, horse, yes, bitch, I am, and I don't know. Why, I'm blind, I'm choking, silly. Forgive me. I'll get off. Off the bitch, off the horse. Have you a handkerchief? Horses don't have handkerchiefs, but bitches might do. To wipe their crevices that stinks, I'll say that stinks of filthy copulations. Am I to wipe my eyes with that eyes? Am I to wipe my eyes with that? Yes, wipe away and fuck your finicky fastidious sin. Women are so coarse. They are. They are coarse, more so than men. Vastly more, vastly, I have noticed it. More coarse than men. The polite ones are the worst. Behind their downcast eyes, these swarming vocabularies. Yes, yes, certainly I'll call later. I'll cry later. Yes, certainly I will cry later. Gertrude enters. How did you kill my father? I can't work it out. There is no mark on him. I'm crying later. Say you understand. I'm crying later. Yes, later if you wish. Later. Or if you don't wish, not at all. Not at all. Yes, I had not thought of that, the possibility of not crying. So enslaved are we by these conventions, I had not for a single moment contemplated tearlessness, when tearlessness might be my way with death. Forgive my shocking manners. Yes, I hide in shocking, yes. When all the time I think these people are not shocked. No. It is so hard to shock them. I am failing to shock them. Look, they, yes, are utterly unmoved. When eventually I cease these futile efforts, I shall perhaps have passed through the purgatory of adolescence. Yes. Possibly. Basically, what I wonder if there's any conclusion specifically from these scenes. I would like to just give a feel, the idea of how he writes. And he explains another scene that he has written, which might give a little bit of idea about the theater catastrophe, a catastrophic moments, as he calls it, when he puts extremes of emotions and human conditions next to each other and allows them to collide, and it's specifically very hard for actors, and of course for the audience, which we get to it later a little bit. Yeah. Okay. The removal of the moral climate from a scene. He is very interested in that. He's not interested in any moral message or moral dependency on any idea. So he would like to remove anything moral, anything that you would find any pattern that you can actually call and say, okay, I know the pattern and this is the result. The removal of the moral climate from a scene, or more precisely, the suspension of moral predictability reaches a sort of apotheosis in my work in the 10 short plays called The Possibilities, which were seen at the Almeida in 1988. Each of the plays predicates a politics of oppression. In the various circumstances of the play, historic, contemporary, theocratic, or collectivist, the characters are invited to behave diplomatically, logically, or expediently by superior powers. In the one play I wish to discuss here called Kiss My Hands, the wife of a radical activist inadvertently betrays her husband to his murderers, who visit their home at night. She allows them entry when they plead they have a sick comrade with them. Her husband has already thoroughly rehearsed her in the rules of not opening the door, and her lapse leads to his murder. As he is dragged away to be shot, she experiences a fit of remorse and horror, and calling her child from his bedroom, she attempts to suffocate him with a pillow, staggering over the stage in a breathless struggle whose intention is to prevent the world inflicting any further damage on his innocence. This action and its choreography and its complete surprise is dramatically beautiful and intellectually subversive. Its power derived from what is, objectively speaking, wrong thinking. After an almost intolerable duration, the woman abandons her attempt at infanticide, recovers some degree of mental stability, and embracing her child, declares in what must be a supreme burst of contradictory logic that she will continue to open the door. Objectively, therefore, she may be considered to be insane, since opening the door was precisely the cause of her pain. This play, like the others, offers neither advice nor instructions. It is ideologically void, and like the other example, which I haven't actually shared with you, cannot be comprehended in the normal terms of political discourse. None of the examples are, none of them are suggestive, nor they manipulative, nor are they manipulative of the audience in a realist way, since they do not aspire to indicate correct action or correct analysis. Furthermore, in their complexity and contradictory nature, they divide the audience into its individual components, a moment of fragmentation that I believe to be a significant characteristic of theater of catastrophe. This return to individual pain is unassuageable through recourse to political orthodoxy, but the power of its visual and linguistic poetry enhances the nature of the problem to an extent that denies the possibility of catharsis and creates a genuine moral anxiety. In this way, catastrophic beauty is, in my view, more deeply subversive than critical realism purports to be. In this way, catastrophic beauty is, in my view, more deeply subversive than critical realism purports to be. So, let me see. Yes. Basically, his work is an assemblage of Deleuzian term. I had the value not to use Deleuzian terms, but anyways, is an assemblage of moments of catastrophe, allowing them to collide, and that's specifically very hard for the actor, because there's no arc, there's no psychological arc to find, and he's not interested in that at all. And he's proposing that this is the way we can actually reach some deeper emotions, some things that we never usually feel, and the dark moments of human existence. His power is in his inconsistencies. One of his actors says, to learn how to play each moment, each scene, for what is worth, how to turn on a sixpence and not to try to iron out the inconsistencies. The inconsistencies are there and we have to play them because it's in their collision that the central dynamic is to be found. The most persistently resonant plays are those with the greatest plurality of meanings. Now, this is all, I understand he writes very dense. It's even very hard for me to speak it. But I plan to finish soon. When did we start?
Seven-ish.
Okay. Because in that, I think it's... Okay, I'll make it short. Now, yeah, let's do that. Barker again. The theater lies under a shroud. The masses cannot be served, whilst it is the vanity of the entertainment industry to posture as the allies of the inarticulate. Only individuals can be stimulated by a work of art, and only those individuals with a desire for complication. And only those individuals with a desire for complication will find in it the ecstasy of moral uncertainty. The individual who aches to know suffering as an entrance to an unknown world will sit in the dark, crucially dark, to disengage from his neighbors, and watch theaters unforgotten, though lying beneath the shroud of conscience, packed with illegitimacy. In contrast to the humanist play or the socialist play, the play of conscience in its many forms, the tragedy demands you leave your morals at the door. For in this space, absolutely not the street, the beauty of the actor is not blurred by urges to educate, to elucidate, to or edify. The message is absent. The message is abolished by obscurity. In an age obsessed with accessibility, what greater crime could the artist and the actor commit? Yeah. A couple of more quotes, and then I'll finish it with a very short part of this book again. Barker says, I did not understand the play. Quote from the audience, that's what he says. I did not understand the play. You were not invited to understand it. We did not understand it either. We merely believed it. Do you want to diminish all life? How weak it is to hear an audience was moved, and even weaker to hear how it was informed. Better that the audience was enraged, not from the antics of offense, but from the exposure of its hidden crimes. These crimes, the worst crimes, are crimes against personal experience. Theater indicts the unlived life. Yes. The state of loss at the end of a dramatic performance. This is the last piece. I thank you for your patience. The theater of humanism, radical criticism, and celebration seeks a single end, the reassurance of the audience, the satisfaction of the bargain struck at the box office between the purchaser of comfort and the suppliers of delight. The payment entails a dispensation from the actors to the audience in the form of perceptions. This is the gratification of expectations, the sordid currency of spiritual exchange, inevitably barren. I left with more than I brought in. My store was enhanced. I profited. In the theater of catastrophe, the foyer has none of the hum which characterizes the stock exchange of entertainment. The end of the efforts of writer, director, actors, is a state of loss. Nothing is described here by the term creative. The discreditable Nothing is described here by the term creative. The discredited alibi of populist culture in search of a leisure which is ethically justified. The state of loss describes a state of lost morality, an ethical vacuum, a denial, a rebuke to order, a melancholy and a pain. It is revelation of the essential terror of the world and an abyss. The ability of an audience to expose itself to these absences is possibly only through the heroic efforts of the actor and the unflinching qualities of the text. Only by poetry can melancholy be made tolerable, and only the poetic actor can bear the audience through its pain. This pain is necessity. The theater of catastrophe is not the comfort of a cruel world, but the cruelty of the world made manifest and found to be beautiful. That's the end of the Barker talk. I thank you. But a couple of more things I do want to share. I used, of course, the book, Argument for the Theater, Gertrude the Cry, and also parts of Graham Saunders' Howard Barker's Monstrous Assaults, Eroticism, Death, and the Antique Text. Now, two things that I have the responsibility. No? Are we good on time? No? So, this is more like a talk, I guess. I'm just going to share two concerns of the Biting School on behalf of Arash and myself. One of them was that there was a time that I guess the Issue magazine was a trigger of it for it as well. I was like, what has been done here in Vancouver? And I guess I had a chat with David and Brian about it as well. In this, it seems like we all constantly want to create new stuff, original stuff, and to the point that we've lost connection to the past. And I was wondering if anybody else feels like that. And because past has always been a source of confidence for me. I'm not talking about the old past, maybe 30 years ago, 20 years ago, when people who have been alive and active at the time are still alive, actually, we can talk to them. But it seems they might not have the interest to talk about it, and we don't necessarily, we as the younger ones, don't have any interest to ask about it. And especially when we keep saying that, okay, no, we're a young society, we don't have history, but we actually do have history. And I wish we could use more of that. A huge part of it was when I was looking at the Issue magazine, I'm like, oh, the old ones. Very, very powerful stuff. I'm like, wow, these things happen. But we never know about them. And it seems there's a disconnect there. Now, that's one of the concerns. We can get back to it. Arash, if you have something, please later on add to it. Yes. Maybe this look back to the history, it's like a search for feedback or something to feed into the growing process that I would like to have or my society would like to have. Then is it criticism or this? Is that what I'm longing for? Because I also miss it from the presence as well. I know there's a lot of talks, basically I'm saying criticism is missing from our talk about dance and theater. This is not a new thing, of course. We also have a Facebook page called Talking About Dance. And we also have an event that Justine and... Yes, and an event that Justine and Soufie lead once a while. So there's a need for it. But I'm also asking for more criticism in a maybe... Okay, what happens is that people talk to each other. The circles of friends talk to each other. We see a show, we talk to each other. But none of these circles actually talk to, like, with each other. All of this, I guess the example of it was when recently a show happened and so many of the audience left, finding it very sexist. But they would talk to each other, but nobody would actually convey the message somehow to the creator or to the dancers maybe. And I was wondering about all this. I'm wondering, how can we non-violently discuss? How can we share if we're enraged by something? If we're disturbed? And do we even need to do that? Maybe, like Barker says, you just make disturbing stuff and things shift in a way. I don't know. Because I always thought talking is necessary. Now, in the visual arts practice, I see, well, at least in training, when visual arts in training, a lot of criticism happens, but I don't see a lot of it in dance and theater. And I understand it can be really brutal because you're dealing with the body, and but also it doesn't shouldn't be like that. Why? My question is again, why visual arts has more systematic criticism, while theater and dance doesn't really have that. Do we need it? I don't know. Also having in mind that we have a young scene and we don't want to discourage by too much of a harsh criticism. I have these questions.